Well, good morning, and thanks for coming. So today, I just briefly review what we learned last Friday. And first, I want to briefly review the connection between the physical ideas and the metric formulas and the field. So what's the name of this?
It's depending on which dimension you are, but mm-hmm. So we are in 3D, so we can, this one is a quadriad.
Triad? Oh, okay, but in a lot of geometric textbooks, they are called field by field, and maybe I'm more used to that. So if sometimes I say this word, this just means this E mu m. So this, what's the physical meaning of this field by field? They characterize the orientation, the relative orientation between the local inertial frame and the coordinate basis frame on your curved space. So you can lower or upper the index by this field by field of a vector. And the vector components in the local inertial frame and a coordinate basis frame are related by this formula. They can be related by the corresponding field by field. And what's the relation between these two formulas? They can be briefly revealed as this. So first, the first physical idea is that the parallel transport is independent of the frame that we use to define a vector. And this physical idea is reflected in this formula. That is the Philbin postulate, or the triad is the covariant derivative of the triad is zero. The physical meaning is that if you impose this Philbin postulate, then the parallel transport in the metric in the curved space are equivalent to that in the local inertial frame. So this is the first physical idea. And the second physical idea is the parallel transport preserves the length of a vector, right? So translate this physical idea in the matrix form, in the metric formula. It is the metric compatibility. It is equivalent to this physical idea. And in the Philbin formula, this idea is translated to this. So the spin connection is anti-symmetric in the two flat index. And how to understand that? So a minute later, you will realize that actually this is the gauge field for local SO3 rotation in three dimension space-time. So it is a Lie algebra valued one form. And this is the form index in the curved space. And this is the matrix index. And so if you want your parallel transport to preserve the length in an inertial frame, then the gauge rotation must be something like SO3, or generally speaking, O3. At Lie algebra value, it is equivalent to SO3. So this gauge field must live in the Lie algebra of SO3 if you want to preserve the length of a vector under parallel transport. So, and you know that the representation matrix for the Lie algebra of SO3, the matrix index is anti-symmetric. So here you must have anti-symmetric if you understand it as a gauge field. And the third physical idea is torsion-free. Physically, the meaning is that you don't have fermion in your system that couple to spin connections. And you translate this into the matrix formula. What's that? It means that you choose Christoffer connection. That these two index are symmetric. If this is the meaning of torsion-free. And how to translate it into the Philbin formula? In the Philbin formula, if you don't have torsion, then it just means that the spin connection is totally determined by your Philbin field. Otherwise, you will have other correction term like, for example, in supergravity, you have quadratic term in fermion field that's besides the Philbin field. So torsion free just means that you can fully determine the spin connection by your Philbin field. This is the connection of this two formula. And then return to what we learned last Friday. So we first talk about the curvature. Curvature, geometrically, its meaning is that the discrepancy of a vector when you do parallel transport on a closed path. And mathematically, it is the commutator of two covariant derivative. And you will find that the curvature in metric formula is the same as that in the Philbin formula, up to some lower and upper index. And it is quite reasonable, since if you assume that parallel transport is frame independent, then the Riemann geometry should remain the same. So they are the same. And then the spin connection is the what is the gauge field for the local SO3 rotation. And then we define, I'll be quick. We define two tensor. The first is the curvature. So the curvature two form is just the covariant derivative of this connection one form. And the other one is the torsion two form. The torsion two form is just the covariant derivative of the Philbin. So if you just check the metric index, they will coincide. They will coincide. And then this we write the action of the general relativity as this case in the Philbin formula. And then we talk about the gauge structure of this action, and we will find that there are three gauge symmetries. The first is diffeomorphism, and another is local Lorentz transformation. And the third one is called covariant transport, and actually, covariant translation. And actually, in my opinion, actually, this is equivalent to a linear combination of the first two. Otherwise, you need a third gauge field, but you don't have a third gauge field. And you can prove that on shell, the third gauge transformation is equal to the first one plus the second one. So this is the gauge structure. So the only two gauge symmetry, the first is the diffeomorphism. Whose gauge field is the connection? And the second gauge symmetry is the local SO3 rotation. And the gauge field is the spin connection. And so I will finish in 1 minute. And then we discussed the Hamiltonian formula for gravity. So we need a foliation in space and time. And so we will find that in this system, in the action of this system, there are two Lagrangian multiplier which don't have time derivative. And this is just the something like this. And the meaning is that their corresponding equation of motion also don't have any time derivative. So an intuitive way to understand what is constraint is that those subsets of your equation of motion that don't include time derivative. And that will constrain the solution of your equation of motion, total set of equation of motion on some hypersurface. And this is another intuitive way to understand what is constraint. And finally, you just by canonical way transform this into the Hamiltonian formula, and you find the Hamiltonian for this gravity system is a fully constrained system. They can just be, So it is something like, so the Hamiltonian is a linear combination of constraint. And OK, that's all I want to talk about. I'm sorry for out of time.
onto the other here. So so today, now we did indeed, as Roshan just mentioned it, we did the canonical analysis of our system, which is 3D gravity, 3D Euclidean gravity here, and so what we get is that this system is totally constrained, with here being what we call the flatness constraint, and here the Gauss constraint. And so now the idea is how to interpret this constraint. And as it was reminded to, like, we have, so indeed, only as a gauge symmetry, what do we have? So we have the DFAO, we have the internal rotation and translation. But you're right that all of them are not independent. You can write the DFAO as a linear combination of translation and internal rotation on shell. Okay, so that's again why 3D gravity is so simple. It's because the DFAO homomorphism invariance is going to be just encoded in this. We're going to kind of replace this DFAO invariance into just using the Gauss transformation, the internal rotation, and the translation. Okay, so now the question is, what are these constraints? So first we need to understand if these constraints are indeed first class or if we are not missing any constraints. And so this is going to be obtained by looking at what we call the constraint algebra. But usually it's easier to first look at the action of this constraint on each of our variables of our system. And this will give us already what kind of, what are the interpretation of this constraint. And by interpretation here, I mean which kind of symmetry are going to generate this constraint, okay? So we're going to start with that. And so this is the first part, interpretation of the constraint. And you're also going to work on that during the tutorial. To do it explicitly for the rotation. So here, more or less, what I'm going to do is kind of only one aspect of the calculation, one side of the calculation, to really understand get the interpretation, you do to do another part of the calculation that you will do in the tutorial. So first, usually, these constraints are going to be, so our two constraints are the flatness again and the Gauss. So we're first going to focus on the Gauss constraint. But for both constraints, it's going to be better defined at least if we look at what we call smeared constraint. Okay, so here I'm going to look, and it's going to become clear in a moment. And it's going to be easier than the just pointwise constraint. So we just choose one lambda here. And to say that this constraint is vanishing at each point of our manifold on our 2D surface is the same as saying that it's vanishing for all of these variables here. So all choice of lambda. And I'm going to do the same with the flatness constraint, sorry. So I want to introduce, I'm going to use another parameter here, which is kind of and now the question are to look at the infinitesimal changes associated to the to these two constraints. So let's start with the Gauss constraint. And so the question is, what is the infinitesimal and this is a kind of calculation you have to do associated to the. So we're going to look for the phase space variable. So yeah, this is a kind of calculation you have to do very generally for any kind of constraint system. Let's So this we want to look associated to the Gauss constraint. So maybe let me just recall what are the, yeah, so indeed, so we mentioned here that these two variables were the E0 and A0 were just Lagrange multipliers. So what are the dynamical variables? What are our phase space variables here? Our phase space variables were, so the connection on, so the A indices here, again, are just the spatial index on the 2D surface, OK? And this is what we are going to consider as our configuration variable, and it's conjugated to a densitized triad. If you remember the definition, it's just an epsilon AB times the triad, and to have indices. So again, the B is also a special index here of Y. JK. OK, so now the question is, what is the infinitesimal change of, for example, let's first look at the densitized triad. So what we want to compute here, what does it mean? This means that this is what is the flow generated by this constraint on this variable. OK, so let's maybe just do this one explicitly, or at least these two explicitly. So here it's at the given point x. And here I'm going to use this smeared variable. So I get this smeared constraint. So what was the expression again of this constraint? As Roshan mentioned it, it's just the covariant derivative of this densitized triad. So let me just put different indices here, plus. So K, M, L, A of Y, E. OK, and this is integrated over on the 2D surface. OK, so here E is conjugated with A. So the only non-vanishing Poisson bracket here are this one. OK, so here it's very simple. It's between these two variables. And this gives us a delta AB, delta JL. OK, so the J, L, here, M are internal indices, or K, too. And I get a delta between X and Y, which is going to keep this integration here. OK, so what do I get? Oh, and maybe a minus sign. Because it's AE. OK. So I'm keeping only this term. So I get epsilon k, m is still m, l is j. Then I get the e. Now b is a. I keep m. And I'm missing the lambda. And I'm missing the minus, sorry. And this is evaluated at x. OK, so do I get what I'm expecting? J. Not sure. Yeah, I have the right sign. Oh, no, this is. So yeah, so this is epsilon J. I'm wondering if I don't have a sign issue here. MK Okay, so here, sine should be, well, I think, so you all agree with what I wrote. So yeah, this has to be now compared with, okay, so the question is now, what is this, what does it mean here? That we get the infinitesimal change for the density text triad is given by this expression. What are we expecting? I think. Is that me doing this? Oh, I lost the thing or what? Okay, sorry about that. Yeah, so what is, are we expecting the Gauss constant is going to generate which kind of transformation? And I think maybe you can already recognize it here. And you're, again, you're going to compute that explicitly in the tutorial today. So which kind of transformation are we expecting? So remember that this two symmetry we expect to find, or three symmetry if we have the internal rotation, the translation, or DFO. Okay, but as I already mentioned it, we're going to replace the DFO by translation. So here we are more or less expecting to get the rotation, internal rotation, and translation. Okay, so can you recognize this as a rotation, an infinitesimal rotation on this vector? Okay, this is for space. The space spatial index has this A. So here what you want to compute now, and it's what you're going to do in the tutorial, you want to look at a rotation that can be written like this. Okay, so this is a finite rotation. But then you want to go to epsilon, kind of very small, go to zero to get the infinitesimal. So what is the idea? You want to act, so either you know already what is the expression of an infinitesimal rotation on this kind of object, or you act with the rotation on this kind of object, and then you go to infinitesimal level. And the idea is that, of course, you compare these two sides, and you say, oh, yeah, indeed. What is this constraint doing is it's generating an infinitesimal rotation on my vector here. OK, so this sign, and again, the sign here, I'm not. So this is to compare. So see tutorial this afternoon. To compare with R acting on and when epsilon goes to zero. Okay, so the infinitesimal version of this. Okay, so let's maybe just look now at the action of this same constraint, but now on the other variable, so the conjugated one. And I'm also going to start doing it with you because just that you, here we have a trick. Well, it's not really a trick, but you need to do, it's just an integration by parts, so it's maybe not really a trick. But it's good that you see it once and then you can do it yourself. So I'm using the same expression as above here. Epsilon K M L B E B M. And so now A is the non-zero bracket will be. So here I'm going to do an integration by parts. So this term is just, and I don't care about the boundary terms, or I choose manifold and I don't have any boundary terms. And then so here we're going to get this bracket that is non-zero and this one, okay? So let's write this explicitly.
So from here, I get a delta AB, a delta IJK, and that all. So I get delta A lambda J. Okay, and then plus epsilon. So here I get a delta M J and a delta AB. Okay. So K J L L A. And each time I got a delta XY plus an integration. So it's all over evaluated on X. And what you should get here. Am I missing something? Yeah, I'm missing a lambda here, which should be K then. So again, so everyone agrees with me with the signs. So here I should get kind of the covariant minus the covariant derivative of this lambda. Is it that? Okay, so let's write it explicitly. Okay, and again, this is to compare with. So the first one is to compare with the transformation on a covector, and this one on a connection that are associated with this infinitesimal rotation. Okay. Yeah. So sorry, here I said something not totally correct. So we're looking at the rotation for the internal indices. Okay. So this object, the densitized thread here for the internal rotation is as a covector. Okay. So what you need to indeed R is going to act. So here. So you need to look at the action of the rotation on a covector for the first one and not a vector, and the rotation, the action of a rotation on a connection for the second one, and then go to the infinitesimal level, compare both things, and say yes, oh yeah, indeed, my Gauss constraint is generating infinitesimal rotation. Okay, so here, see tutorial to conclude, but the conclusion to really conclude. And I mean, once you get used to this infinitesimal transformation, you can recognize it. You don't really have to do the other part of the calculation, but if it's the first time, it's better to do it. So that Gauss constraint generate infinitesimal rotation for the internal index. Okay, great. So this is, and here we haven't checked yet what is the constraint algebra, but usually it's what you expect from first class constraint, is that your first class constraint generates your gauge symmetry. Okay, so this was one gauge symmetry of our system. Yeah.
What's the meaning of smeared constraints?
So here, it's just that, and we're going to see that it's going to be the same with variable. So first, there is kind of a mathematical, not meaning, but a mathematical justification is we don't really like when a constraint is going to is pointwise and going to depend on the point, and then you have all this delta that go around. And so here, and it's really equivalent to say that the constraint, the first constraint without smearing, is going to vanish on all points of your manifold or 2D surface here, then it's going to vanish for all lambda here that we get. Okay, so it's just that, and we're going to see that when we're going to go to basic variables, to quantize G, we try also to get rid of the of the delta that goes around. So we're also going to use smeared variables, kind of. It's for the equivalent of smeared variables.
More of a mathematical convenience than a physical.
So physically, but as, I don't think there is really deeply a physical reason to do it. But again, even to see the, when we're going to do at the level of the constraint algebra, to compute what we call the constraint algebra, we also deal with smeared constraint. And the interpretation we get is really using smeared constraint. So I don't really know how we can hear. And we see that to compute the smeared, the constraint algebra, we really need to do this kind of integration by part here that we're doing. So otherwise, we're missing terms. And we get some, we'll get some constraint with many deltas function infinities everywhere. So. Okay, so quickly, I gave you on Friday what would be that you can check explicitly that indeed your action written here is invariant under this, this infinitesimal translation. And here you can really check that if now you look at the infinitesimal changes associated to the flatness constraint, okay, for these two variables. So here, maybe this one is easier to, you can, you don't need to do really many calculations. Sorry, so here, JAX, and we want to look at this Poisson bracket. So you know what is the result here? Do you remember what is this flatness? I think Richard mentioned it, that the flatness is just written as a covariant, kind of covariant derivative on the on the connection. So what do you get? Yeah, okay, because here you only have connection variables. The connection with the connection is always zero. And this is the result we will, what we expect from a translation. Okay, and so here, if you do the same calculation, but with E here, what you get is C A of X, okay, so I'm not doing it explicitly, I let you check. And so here, the conclusion is flatness constraint generate infinitesimal translation, or translation, you can just say. Again, since we are expecting a DFAO symmetry, how do we see that we have a DFAO symmetry in our theory? And so how this DFAO is going to appear here. So if you first look, so where is the DFAO? Let's just clarify this first, and then so the idea of the DFAO is that the infinitesimal change of the field under DFAO is going to be given by, again, the Lie derivative. So you should have seen that in the, remind this in the tutorial, in the homework. And you're also going to work on that in the tutorial. So it's just given by the Lie derivative of this field. So here in terms of coordinate, sorry. I remind you the expression J plus J mu and on a connection, you would get, again, it's given by the lead derivative on this field, and you have similar expression plus so you can, using this, you can check as before, you can check explicitly. So this is kind of exercise here. Check explicitly that your action is invariant. Okay, this is the first thing to check. And then what we can show is that indeed this DFeO symmetry is hidden in the translation symmetry. So how do you see that? Is that you can write, and it's going to be on shell. So I need to define this new vector field that I'm going to explain. So this is the infinitesimal transformation under rotation, okay? Plus the infinite on this triad, plus the infinitesimal transformation associated to a translation with, again, this new vector field here, can be written as the infinitesimal transformation associated to a DFeO, okay, plus some torsion term here that, as we've seen, is zero on shell. Okay, this is given by your equation of motion, or it's your constraint. So this is your constraint. And so right here, what I mean is that this is and this one. So yeah, sorry, these are not vector fields anymore, they are scalars. Okay, and if you look at the same kind of, you have the same kind of equation on your now connection. So here, of course, I change again notation. This should be the connection, so here's A. And but it's not, yeah, it's even, it's at the space-time level, and we haven't done here the splitting. And again, you get something similar. So the transformation associated to a rotation and the translation equal a DFeO on this same variable plus something proportional to the flatness constraint. Okay. So that's why, again, we won't try to, yeah, we're going to work, and anyway, in the, so the way we're going to do the Dirac program is then you have constraint and you need to impose this constraint at the quantum level already, because if you remember, the first step of the quantum program is the Dirac program, and it's what we're going to do today, is to define what we call the kinematical phase space, okay? The kinematical Hilbert space, based on the kinematical phase space. So anyway, we don't really work directly with symmetries in this framework. We really work at the level of the constraint, but we see that having a good understanding of what these constraints are doing is going to be really useful, because again, usually it's very difficult to turn constraint into operators that are well defined. So because we have a nice understanding of this constraint, we're going to be able to say, oh, we know that the Gauss constraint is going to impose this SU2 invariance or SO3 invariance, but we're going to see that we're going to work with SU2, okay? Okay, Great. Any questions here on the interpretation of the constraint? Okay, so if no question here now, what is also, of course, really important to check is what is our constraint algebra, okay? And meaning our constraint, are they first class or not? So, and for this, we need to look at the constraint algebra. And it was easier to do this way, meaning to look already at the action of the constraint on our phase space variable, because then you can use this result directly to compute explicitly the bracket between the different constraints. So here, we want to look at and once we will have that, we can indeed check that the counting of degrees of freedom is correct. I already mentioned it, so it should be fine. So here, what we want to compute is, for example, the bracket between and so what does it mean that they are first class? What we expect is that what we have on this side should be, again, a constraint, okay, or a sum of constraints. And so here, you can indeed so use what we just did before, okay? You can use the result here on the basic variables. So you can really say that here what we have is kind of, again, we do this integration by part, KB. So it's a prime on this side plus epsilon KLM lambda prime K. And then we get the connection. And I'm not going to do everything. I just want to give you the steps. This is a kind of calculation. It's good if you try to do it yourself sometimes. And then on this side, since we already computed the action of this constraint on the basic variable, we can directly use the result we get from these two calculations, okay? So here on this one, and here you have these two terms. But we don't have to redo everything. So this is the first step. So then you use action of g lambda on basic variable. Then you're going to get a given result with, again, a derivative on this lambda. So you need to do, again, an integration by part. Okay. So I'll let you do exercise. Will be to do that explicitly. So then the next step is to do, again, integration by part to get rid of the derivative on lambda. And then you will see that you can use the identity, which is just kind of the Jacobi identity for, so you know that we have Jacobi identity for the, any algebra. So here, it's going to translate on a kind of identity on this structure constant, okay? So here, then, it's kind of use this kind of Jacobi identity here, which is for the structure constant of the rotation group. So I give it to you. So L PQ, so you just have this kind of equation to simplify. So this can give you an idea that you have a nice some nice expression before that. LMQ plus epsilon PML LQ KQ. Okay. Well, this is what you correct, but you understand the idea. And so what you get here is, and I'm going to write it explicitly because then usually the way this result is written is maybe a bit mysterious if you don't see the real expression. So what we get here, it's going to help you to understand in case you're not really familiar with Lie algebra valued object. This is going to be the meaning of, okay, so hopefully all my indices, so I'll let you check all these indices, at least for the summation part. Okay, and then I just have one integration left. So you see that we had two integrations. Kept only once. And here, we can rewrite this as just epsilon k q l lambda prime k, and then lambda q times here we can recognize that here what we get is just the Gauss constraint again. So you see that indeed it's going to be a smeared Gauss constraint, the result, smeared with this new parameter written in terms of our initial parameters. Okay? And so usually what we get is that it's, we define this as a new smearing function. So here, what is the index left is the L. And what this is going to mirror is really the SU2 algebra commutation relation, because indeed, if now I'm going to define when I don't have any index here, this means that I'm considering kind of SU2, Lie algebra valued object. So what I mean here is that indeed, I can, if lambda prime and lambda are my SU2 Lie algebra valued object, this means that explicitly what I mean is just something like this. So this is this object without index. And k, tk. And so, of course, these two are the SU2 generators, so they do not commute anymore. And this can be explicitly written as epsilon jkl. So the lambda prime j is out, the lambda k is out, and this one gave me a new generator, L. So this indeed defines what is your lambda prime prime L. Okay? And so here, this is the way we write the Gauss, the bracket between the Gauss constraint, is that the Poisson algebra of the Gauss constraint is indeed a representation of the SU2 Lie algebra, and this translated by this equation, sorry. And so this is okay. So this equation here, sorry, it's a bit messy the way I wrote it, tell you that the Gauss, the algebra for the Gauss constraint is a representation of the SU2 Lie algebra. And so this is only one constraint, so I'm not going to do the calculation for the rest. But so if I give you the complete constraint algebra here, so what is the complete constraint algebra? So this one is the one we kind of, I explain you the meaning explicitly. So I let you check the calculation. It's a good kind of exercise, something that you will have to do often as soon as you deal with constraint system. And then if now we look at the bracket between the flatness and one Gauss constraint, it is what we expect, OK? A translation and a rotation usually give another translation. So, but it's a translation for which the parameter has been rotated, kind of. So here, what you get. And again, when I'm using this object without indices here, you should really, when it's inside the bracket, this really means that you're talking about Lie-valued object, OK? And here, as expected, since these two things are only function of the connection here, OK, you really expect that this is 0. And so what this is going to tell you is that this constraint algebra just mirrors SO3 or R3 and is, so this is, it is closed, OK? If you mean. And so all these constraints are first class. And again, if now we go back to the counting of degrees of freedom here, so our basic variable are given by the kinematical phase space is described by these variables here, OK? With J taking three indices, you have three indices, and A is 2. So it's 6 plus 6. So it was 12. And again, we have 3 plus 3 constraints at each point again. So since they're all first class, the counting of degrees of freedom tells you that it's 12 minus 6 times 2. So you get 0 as expected. And again, it's because you need to divide by the once you're on your constraint surface, you also need to divide by your gauge orbit to get the number of physical degrees of freedom. Okay, so here you will recover that there is no local degrees of freedom. Okay, any questions here? Okay, so now we can start going to the Dirac program. So do you remember what is the first step of the Dirac program? It is. It's a good strategy to look back to your lecture notes to remember.
Presentation of phase space variables.
OK, great. Yeah, so it's to find the representation of the phase space variable as operator in a kinematical in a Hilbert space, okay? And really the important part is, so in this sentence, usually the Hilbert space is kind of, a framework, but the important part is really to find representation of your variable as operators, okay? So here, what are basic variables we have right now is this connection and the densitized triad, okay? So these are kind of basic variables. But we, so let's maybe write explicitly what we're going to do. So I'm going to keep this because we have the variable, but I don't really need this one. So now we can finally impose, look at the Dirac program. On our system, which is 3D gravity here. So the first step, and we're going to spend some time on this first step, is find. So this is step one. Find a representation of basic or phase space variable. But the kinematical phase space as operators in a kinematical Hilbert space. And we want, of course, that the standard commutation. So we're going to start with a phase space. So our variable satisfied have some. We have a symplectic structure there, given by this Poisson bracket. So as operator now, they're going to become non-commutative. Okay, object. But this selection of here, we need to select kind of our basic variable. You see that, of course, when it's x and p, we choose that as our basic variable, and we everything is fine. But in fact, it's not always possible for all phase space function to define them as operators. Okay, so this is even a theorem that we have here. So what we want is try to find a set of variables that, of course, their Poisson bracket is going to be simple enough. Okay. But here, what we don't like really about this Poisson bracket is that we have all this, we have this delta function here. And we don't really like when, because this Poisson bracket are kind of distribution, and this is, and are point dependent. Okay. So at this at the quantum level, this function won't have really won't be really a proper operator, okay? But rather an operator with value in distribution. And so the idea would be, can we get rid of this before going to the quantum? At the quantum level. And so there is a trick here that to get rid of this distribution, okay? So the first point is really to choose these basic variables. So such as, of course, the brackets between them is simple. So what does it mean simple? We're going to see usually is that, and if possible, without a delta function, or at least. By delta, I just mean, yeah. So without delta function here, meaning that we don't want distribution. And I'm just going to give you kind of the general recipe. And we're going to see that maybe you already heard that the basic operator are going to be the holonomy and the flux. And this comes really from this idea. So here, the trick is the solution to this is to smear basic configuration variable. And so this is really general. So I'm just going to give you the general thing, and we're going to deal with our specific case tomorrow. So the basic configuration variable, so for us, our configuration variable is going to be our connection. And we're going to see what is the choice of this k-dimensional hypersurface. Is and so configuration and then the conjugated variables over k d minus k if d is the dimension of your theory. And so we're going to see tomorrow that applying this to gravity, to what we're going to get is holonomy flux variable. And this would anyway coincide with. So this is the basic building block of loop quantum gravity. And with the canonical variable you would use in kind of lattice gauge theory, OK? OK, so I need to stop here because I'm